And we are back. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Daily Dots. I am joined, as always, by the Brain Trust, Mr. Chase Taylor. And yeah, I got a little dot action today. We were commenting before we got started off the air. I was telling Chase that of course this is great content, right? It's us. It's me, you know. It's we don't do anything but put out the very best. I'm sure you guys are sitting by your phone, just counting down the time until you see that announcement that the next Dots is out. So we don't want to keep you waiting, guys. You know, we're gonna when the ducks are quacking, we've got to feed you guys. And if you don't know that I'm joking, you probably haven't listened to the show before. But anyway, kind of give us a brief update. But you and I started a conversation that I think really I think bears repeating, and I think it bears getting deeper into. And the reason I think it bears getting deeper into is because, first of all, I think it's somewhat historic. B, I was thinking about it all weekend long, man. There's a lot of esoteric things happening right now that I feel like it's hard to, and I've heard that on other podcasts that I've talked. I think things have gotten really confusing for the average person. And I think sometimes I can forget my own mandate of when we started this show, which was to not tiptoe around, to attack the really complex, big financial issues of the day, but do it in a way that we can make – the average man is smart enough to understand what's going on, right? It's just that the topic is dressed in so much esoteric nonsense, which I think is on purpose, right? And not on purpose, like it's some kind of cabal. Just you and I both know this industry. If I can say something in three words, I'm going to opt to say it in 100 with as many multisyllabic, vocab words that I can possibly throw together, because that, of course, means that I'm smarter, right? And so what's really funny is even within the realm of professionals, you sit around and listen to a room full of people and you realize that they sat around for 2 hours and nobody said anything.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how often is that the case, Chase?
Yeah, it reminds me of Alan Greenspan. He said, "If I seem unduly clear to you, you must have misunderstood what I said." he tried really hard to dress it up so much that people didn't understand him.
Yeah, there you go. So before we get into that, though, because we want to talk about a change. Well, what I'm referring to is a change or a shift in monetary policy. It's really not. It's rather an extension. Before we get into that, let's run through the data on the day. So indexes, what we have, the S&P down 0.31, Q's down, or as NASDAQ down 0.38. Russell finished up on the day right around 0.3.
Yeah, a tiny bit. Okay. MAG 7 down about 0.3. Bond yields were actually up a good bit. The 10-year yield was up almost 5 basis points. The dollar was down about 0.2%. Oil up 1.5%. So
it's a good commodity day, man.
Yeah, especially considering the fact that bond yields were up. And while the dollar was down, it wasn't down a lot. So commodities did pretty decent given that backdrop.
I just know we haven't had a day like that in a while where I wait for the finishing numbers of the day and I saw that we were up 70 bips and I kind of went, whoa, like in a good way, obviously. Yeah. But
Bitcoin was a little bit playing that the role of Atlas there a little bit, but
yeah, but, we,
but also we had oil up and you know our interest rate hedge did well and
we took 200 bips of profit off that Bitcoin position at the end of last week.
Yeah,
so I mean we've
made a huge impact.
Yeah, we even trimmed it. to me, just felt like, and we were talking about it the other day on a strong dollar day. To me, just felt kind of a classic weak dollar day.
Yeah, getting the metals up. Energy up, like you just definitely had a little bit of that going on, and you're seeing some strength in some overseas markets, things that you would see with the dollar kind of weakening. So,
you know, the trade that and it was my idea, so of course I'm going to discuss it and take full credit for it. But it's kind of worked out. But it's been working really good. Is that short Apple, long Google trade?
Yes.
That is not advice. Not advice. Not telling anybody to do that. But I don't know what to make of it, other than the fact that I think that Apple's valuation is just it's ludicrous at this level. And not that it's like it's Apple; they're a beast. I'm not dogging it. But right. What in the world would you pay 30 to 35 times earnings for that company for?
Yeah, the stock grew a lot while the company's earnings didn't. So this it was due for some give back.
Yeah. Yep. And not to mention that, but man, you know, they're so big and they've got so much money, it probably won't matter. But at least historically speaking, I feel like if you were going to check a box, if you were going to check boxes that told the market that the best or, you know, the best part of your run is over, I just feel like Apple's like checked every one of those boxes.
Yeah. Unless you turn face computers into something huge, it's just gonna be tough slog for them, I think.
Well, they haven't innovated or brought anything to the table. These phones that they keep, you know, I would really like to have, you know what I'd love to be able to have? I'd love to be able to have a cell phone expert on the show, and maybe we should dig into that. If anybody knows anybody that really understands these things inside and out, let us know. I'd like to interview somebody. I have watched this with each additional, and I was a longtime Droid loyalist. And I gave into peer pressure because everybody at the office had Apple and it just worked better. You know, they sync better together, all that kind of stuff. I have watched, though, these phones get worse and worse. You remember back in the day, you bought an Apple 6, Apple 7. Like, you just joke, like, our parents, you know, the baby boomers, they had like 8-year-old Apple phones that were still just humming along. These don't do that anymore. At some point, they decided to go the washer and dryer route on these phones, you know, planned obsolescence.
Yes.
It's the only thing that makes any sense to me. And what's really sad about them doing that is, you know, that never would have occurred on Jobs Watch, and it's a complete departure from everything that made them great. I just feel like you've just watched them turn away from everything that they used to be, and it just feels to me like Tim Cook is scared to death to make a mistake and just doesn't want to mess things up.
Yeah, he's running the prevent defense with
total
a minute and a half to go.
Total prevent defense. Anyway, but let's get into the discussion. Well, first of all, anything else? Bitcoin had a big run today. It was up 10%.
Nothing else market-wise, but real quick on the data. New home sales disappointed, and then the Dallas Fed manufacturing survey came out, and that was pretty rough. The numbers were below expectations. But not, I mean, it wasn't crazy, but then you go look at the comments, and they were actually pretty bad.
You know, the other thing I saw today, I've been hearing all these
central bank speeches. I definitely want to get to later.
Okay. I would love to hear that. But I am laughing about how manipulated so much of this data is. So I kept hearing the blowout of new home starts and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, everybody is citing seasonally adjusted data. When you go look at actual new home starts or whatever it was, the actual data, it's declining. It's a pretty defined trend line for about the last year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, the seasonal adjustments are there for a reason, though. Like,
I just don't think they matter in this environment. I think everything is so upside down,
skewed by COVID, like crazy, yeah, and stuff for sure. But
I think they still are. I don't think that you can, like, just things aren't to normal. You know what I mean? Like, it's, well, actually, I should probably say, kind of gets into our conversation that we were about ready to have, and so let's kick it off. That are things abnormal, or is this the new normal? And what got me to asking that question is what we were been talking about this morning, which is, I think that we have, well, I mean, I know we have, but I'm going to say, I think to inject a needed amount of humility into analyzing this, we are no longer using monetary policy to address economic issues. We are now using monetary policy to address monetary policy issues, which I think is a very important distinction. Excuse me. What is that when your brain just malfunctions and the word won't come out?
For me, it was watching a really stressful basketball game last night.
So Chase came in today. He is gray. He went gray overnight. Not really, but it was because you were doing a lot of market. No, it was the NCAA tournament. That was some cardiac action.
Put the madness in March Madness last night.
Chase is a Houston grad. So need I say more? So today is he all decked out in his Houston colors, of course, because they pulled it out. What a game, though. I mean, I know you would have liked to have finished it in a more normal manner.
They're an in-state rival, and I do not like them. But, man, I just talk about a hat tip to a team fighting back. Like, I give them tons of credit.
That was a blood match, man. Those teams fought their tails off.
One of the sideline announcer guy, he said it well. He called it a prize fight. No, that was, yep.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was vintage. Okay, anyway, back to it. One of the things, and I remember you and I talking about this way back years ago. And it's something that I've thought about for a really long time, which was, I thought that you'd see a kind of a convergence of different factors at some point, when in the way that I put it, and for people that have listened to the show for a long time, they'll probably know what I'm saying. They'll probably remember that I've said this, but, I said that, like, when I thought the real inflation, and what I meant by that is not temporary, like the real inflation surge would happen was when the market started figuring out that central banks were all in, meaning that they have created such a false environment that ceasing to aid it would be the same as torpedoing it, right?
Right.
And then the other thing is when we start seeing central banks have to take monetary policy action to do with problems that are a direct result of monetary policy, right? Because that to me is kind of like the Ouroboros, right? It's like the snake eating its own tail at that point.
Right.
And I think we're there.
I think at least in some ways we are. I mean, because some people are arguing like, because in my opinion, it's kind of obvious they probably shouldn't be cutting yet. All things given, some people are arguing like, well, yeah, but they need to because interest costs for the government debt are going up too much.
Yeah, but that's not,
that's a perfect example of like, well, you did that.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, now, granted, like there are forces that are beyond their control that are also playing huge roles in all this, but, so I think at least in part, yeah, like they're dealing with problems of their own making for sure. And I think a lot of people have tried to explain the Fed as sort of a arsonist firefighter in the past. And I think that is becoming more and more true.
Yeah. Well, and in the past, I think that what they were, you know, especially like Bill Fleckenstein, who's been on the show several times, and he's, you know, that's, I think he's the one that actually invented that line, or maybe some, anyway, it was in his book. Maybe stole it from somebody else too. But I think what they're referring to is the Fed being too easy for too long and then overcorrecting. Right. Which if you think about it, I get what he like, and I don't disagree with anybody that's ever said that. Yes, they started the fire and then they put it out. This to me is different though. This isn't that they like let something slide for too long. I feel like now we're dealing with direct repercussions of monetary actions they've taken. Right. The institution of monetary, like they're meaning, you know, we were talking about the bond issue, right? The back end of the curve. And you were talking about how they need the back end of the curve to go up. And I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but yeah, because if they can get the back end of the curve to go up and then they cut rates and bring down the bottom end of the curve, they uninvert, immediately takes a bunch of pressure off banks, right?
Exactly.
Either
kind of reopens the credit channel.
Yep. Kind of reopens, although the credit channel doesn't really seem to be hurting right now, even though it should be.
Depends on for who. Yeah.
Yeah. But that situation is kind of difficult for them because you see what happens, and you and I were talking about it. The minute they start talking about rate cuts, the whole complex, the yields go down. Where they actually need it to go, they need the back end to. It sounds crazy to say this because people have been saying they're going to lose control of the back end. You made a really interesting point though, right before we got on, that they sort of need to lose control of the back end.
I think so because.
And by back end, guys, we mean longer dated bonds, yeah, right? 10, 20, 30 years.
Exactly. So to me, like they, to be clear, like it doesn't seem like they care about financial conditions at all, which is insane. And all we mean by that is like, hey, asset prices going up a bunch loosens financial conditions. And the point of that is if you loosen financial conditions, make asset prices go up, that makes the economy hot. Like that really beefs up consumption. And just gets inflation and growth up higher. So if you know that, and you're going, if you want to cut the front end because of all the problems that's going to cause, you know, get the 2-year yield down, the only way to like keep asset prices cool would be to let the long end kind of go back up. And that it's not guaranteed that it would cool them down much or stop them, but you know, all things being equal, it would be definitely more restrained than if the 30-year yield goes back to like 3.5, then you can't put any check on asset prices at that point. So to me, it would make sense for them to want that. And they have talked about wanting their balance sheet to only be like really short-term debt in the future. So they want to get away from owning a bunch of 10, 20, 30 year bonds and only own, you know, stuff under a couple years. And if that's the case and you have to sell a bunch of that stuff, you would think the price of it would have to go down in order for them to kind of clear that market.
Yeah, that would make a, it'd make a whole lot of sense. What other, I mean, well, you could argue that the inflation was something that they, I think the inflation was more fiscal. Cause the inflation was more fiscal.
It was both, but the fiscal is really driving it.
And then Goolsbee was out today talking. The thing that I think is so amazing about all this rate cut talk, it's just how the goals haven't been reached. It's just incredible to me, like right. how we were talking about, and I don't want to belabor the point because we've talked about it a lot. I just still can't get over the fact that move the goalposts. It doesn't matter. We haven't hit those, you know, we haven't hit these goals. We haven't accomplished things we wanted to, but all of a sudden we're making great progress on it. And you're like, what? And what was the example we were talking about this morning where, now I'm going to space out. Where it was just another example. Oh, Powell talking, the stuff coming out over the weekend about how he's prepared to act. He's prepared to act for the labor market. And you go, what am I missing here?
Yeah.
You got unemployment sub 4. Yeah. And this is why I feel like
5.
Yeah, I feel like they're almost building the – it kind of feels like the run-up to war in Iraq. You're like, we're building all the cases to justify what we want to do except tell you what we're actually doing. Right.
And half of the bullet points you're putting out to justify something just kind of – you just – like they all smell like a rat. So it just,
yeah. Well, because every reason they keep giving you, you're like, yeah, that's not a problem.
Right.
And it's not a problem according to your data. I'm taking you at your word here. Right?
Yeah. I mean, they have – this is why we've talked about on the show like last, I think it was last week. Like to me, like they – went out of their way to basically imply, they're not going to say it, but they implied 2% is not the target anymore. It's higher, at least 2.5. So to make this perfectly clear, like their projections don't have inflation getting back to 2% in the next 2 years. Just today, Bostic, Rafael Bostic, who is, if not the most hawkish, one of the most hawkish people on the FOMC, he currently has one cut priced for the year. So that's really hawkish considering where everyone else is at. And even he went literally out of his way to say, quote, I'm not in a hurry to get back to 2%. So if the guy that only has one cut price this year is not in a hurry to get back to target, like what does that mean for the 15 people that have more than one cut priced? Like what do they want? Someone has 4 cuts priced in the dot plot. So like what does that person – how much do they care about getting back to 2% if the one cut guy doesn't seem to care? To me, that all speaks volumes. And then Goolsbee, he kind of had to say like, okay, sure. Like January, February, inflation was kind of hot. But then he was like, but I refuse to believe the 7 months prior to that were just random. Well, they weren't random, but they like a lot had to go right for you to get that disinflation. Commodities got smoked. You had a lot of deflation coming out.
Well, and the stock market was 15 to 20% lower too.
Yeah, you had a big pullback like in October and stuff. Like it took a lot to get that.
Yep.
It took some base effects to get that. So like, sure, that wasn't random, but neither was the year before that 7 months. And maybe January and February weren't random either. And maybe March is going to print warm. And maybe those 3 months aren't random either. Like it's just, you can feel them like they just grasping want it. Yeah, they just want it. So
yeah.
Like they have an itchy trigger finger, like no question about it. They're kind of like ready, shoot, aim at the moment.
And this gets back to what we were talking about. Like at some point in this country, now people look. I know people are going to be like, "Oh, it's been going on for years." You know, CIA and JFK, and I get all that. Okay, but I'm old enough to remember when a politician or a public servant got up and told a bold-faced lie to the public, and it got found out, he was done.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember when that was the case.
Good old days.
Right? Now it's gotten to the point where it's almost like lying has become part of public policy. Right? And I think it's a really important cultural thing to play out because we're listening to it from, in my opinion, from the Federal Reserve today. Meaning, I'm not calling them evil or untoward or any of that kind of stuff. What I'm saying is the reasons that they're laying out are BS. They're nonsense. they're not telling us the real reason why they want to cut rates, right? Don't you think that's kind of fair to just say that?
Unless they have some labor market data that isn't public, and
then show it to us.
Right, exactly.
Right. But then coming off of Fauci and the pandemic, where he admitted to completely lying, I just feel like we've gotten this point now where it's just okay to lie to the American people. As long as it's getting us what we – and this is the whole problem I see that scares me to death about this country right now, is because nobody follows the rules anymore, right? Like meaning – I feel like I'm in the Big Lebowski where they're on the – doesn't anybody give it about the rules anymore? You know, like we're – hold on a second, guys. You're acting as if there's not a cost for losing the public trust, and I think there's an incredible cost to that. And I think one of those costs that we're paying right now is just societal chaos. Right. Now, obviously, I don't think they're too worried about that. But I mean, I think those are societal costs that are far more, you know, that have far more long term implications than the unemployment rate being at 4 versus 5 or something like that. It's just it's getting nerve wracking, you know, to where you sit there and you listen to these public officials. And look, man, I'm not one of those guys that wants to see it burn. You know, like, and none of us should be, because nobody wins that game, right? Right. It's scorched earth policy. Nobody wins. At the same time, it's just scary the route this is going down, just because what really is going on? We don't know. We don't know why they're making the decisions they're making. It certainly doesn't fit what they're saying it is.
Yeah, to me, it's been a weird few months. Like I've struggled with it. And that's coming for someone that I thought they should be cutting, you know, 6-8 months ago. And like, I've had to completely, and maybe like they just finally came around to the view I had 6 months ago, and I just came around to the view some other people had 6 months ago. But to me, like, it, you either don't care about the 2% target or you do. And they're saying they do care about it while acting like they don't. And there's something behind that that they're just not talking
about. Right. And that's my issue. Cause right. I'm sitting there going, you know what it sounds like? It sounds like, and I don't think this is the case, it sounds like that they see something underneath the surface that they're worried about blowing up the economy.
Right. So, and this is like, you know, it's definitely an accusation, but something we talked about, like with like things like private equity, or I mean, and there's some valid cases for like small banks and things like this that could become a real issue. It's just, it's odd for sure.
Well, we've been talking about this a long time, and there's just something about it, for lack of a better term, I want to say, that's like intellectually or philosophically satisfying about it, in the sense that, I'm trying to put this into words here, but it's, I don't know. I'll try to sum that up, but it's, I don't know. It's somewhat intellectually satisfying, because you see them choking on, like we said, I'll go back to what you said. At the end of the day, you know what we need? We need a recession. Everybody's like, no, but I mean, like, it's a recession resolves a lot of these issues, right? Like it resolves a lot of these issues. You'd see the steam come out of inflation. I don't think you'd get back 2%. I think if, like you and I said, I think you could get back to 2%, but I think it'd be on the way to negative, right? Like, or meaning disinflation. Just yeah. Because if you let it roll.
The volatility of inflation, like its ability to get really pro-cyclical, I think is kind of bigger than usual. And I think the currency side of that plays a role too. Like, but like what I said earlier today is, like, to me, Bostic said the quiet part out loud. It's hard to overstate how meaningful it is for a hawk on a dovish committee to say, I'm not in a hurry to get inflation down to 2%. After they spent, you know, a year talking about there's going to be pain and we have to get it back. We can't let this get entrenched. Like, we can't repeat the mistakes of Arthur Burns. Like, I mean, they just hit you with fire breathing hawkishness. And then all of a sudden they're nowhere near the target. And they're like, who cares about it? Like, we're not in a hurry to do that. Not only are we not in a hurry to, we don't even forecast getting down there until 2026. Like, it makes me wonder too, like, if March inflation again prints a little warmer than expected, and you get 3 months in a row, You know what I mean? Like, if gasoline prices keep going up, they got a problem, right? If that happens, do they just look through a third print in a row? And if they do, like, that's a pretty big signal to me. Like, no, they really don't care. Like, their inflation target is 3. It's not 2 at that, if they are going to keep looking through these. And if that's the case, like, I don't think investors have come anywhere near coping with what it means for the Fed to not care about inflation as long as it's under 3. If it's 2.5 to 3, if they're fine with that, that's a huge deal.
Yeah. Like you and I've said, I think it sets up a Katie bar the door scenario. Like, everything can go to the bloody moon.
It's what they're signaling right now. And it's funny because Powell's gone out of his way to, like, I don't think our star is, moving higher. And for people listening, all that means is, like, where interest rates have to be to keep inflation down. And that's an estimate that has come down basically every year for the last 30, 40 years. And just last week, it kind of popped back up only 10 basis points. So you're barely moving up, but I think it's going to move up a lot, because I think in real life, like, the equilibrium inflation rate is just, it's just higher now because of a bunch of structural reasons and because the deficit's huge.
The other thing that has to do with too is policy. Policy has become so inflationary. Right. Listen to Biden. But Biden comes out, and it's not just him.
With Trump. I mean, he's basically the first MMT president starting in 2016. Does not care about taxes, the deficit stuff. Like, he's hardcore, Like,
yeah. No. Right. But I mean, to be fair, Trump wasn't also staring down the barrels of 6-7% inflation either. So, like, from what I've seen, I don't really think it'd make a difference in his posture on the fiscal side. But I think that, and forget about the party dynamic when I say this, just think about it in terms of the psychological impact, right? Meaning, for pretty much all of our lives, all economic problems that we have faced, except for those people who lived through the 70s, all those economic problems were able to be fixed with a check, right? So Biden comes out with record home and affordability, and he talks about a $10,000 tax credit. You sit there and go, that's inflationary, buddy. Yeah, you're just going to push prices further up. You
don't have enough supply, so let's increase demand.
Yeah. But I think it gives you a look through to how broken DC is, 100%. Right? Which is, the problems we face are completely different, but they're still using the hammer.
Right.
Right? Well, you got to get a screwdriver, man. You need some putty. You need a little. You need a putty knife in there. We need a little sander.
It's frustrating too, because this problem-solving sloth to just throw money at real problems.
Yeah.
Because there are ways to fix all this stuff.
Yeah.
If you just get a few smart people in a room, you sit down and you hammer it out. Like, if you want to fix, like, housing, like, you can do it.
Yeah.
And it just takes some real policymakers to make some real policy.
Yeah.
Not to throw free money at people trying to buy a house that just makes it worse.
Yeah. Or let's start by enforcing antitrust laws. Right? Like, there's so many different things that we can actually do to address these issues that nobody's going to do. And you can see the reason why they're not. You know why antitrust laws don't get talked about anybody, because doesn't help anybody get elected.
Yeah. I think the administration has actually been a little bit more firm on that side. You've seen in the last 2 weeks, all the lawsuits hitting mega cap tech stuff. And I think, now, they're not going to go win the lawsuits and take them down and break them up, like it's the 1800s. But
I just think it's election year nonsense.
But you have – well, this goes back all 4 years, though. What I think it does is it changes behavior on the margins from those companies. And you've already seen it where, like, they're actually opening up app development for Apple. You see Google, like, backing away some from the way they completely monopolized, like – small businesses trying to do things on the internet and making it all go through Google and stuff. Like, they have all had to back down on some of their stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's slow and it's small, but I think them being a little more aggressive on antitrust has made a small difference. So the next administration, whichever side that is, they need to take that ball and carry it a little forward some more.
Yeah, we have to get it under control. We've experienced it here at Bulwark with Schwab buying TD. 100%. And the resulting conglomerate is a disaster. It is the worst trading platform I've ever seen, let alone used. It is a joke. And it's a perfect example of the inefficiencies that come with this. And do you know how those giant consolidated corporations, how do they profit instead of those, you know, despite those inefficiencies? Because they've got total control over the cost. The cost they're passing off to customers, right? It's called a monopoly. That's the whole point. And, you know, when you have monopolies, you don't have capitalism. You don't have competition, I should say.
Right.
Right. And I think competition, I think, you know, capitalism requires competition and so on and so forth. But competition really is one of the things that I think is really, I wouldn't, maybe it's not a top five concern that we face, but it's certainly top 10. I mean, you know, we had Jonathan Tepper on this a few years back about his book, right? The Myth of Capitalism. And I think that you have to be completely checked out not to see that as being a significant problem.
Yeah. And now he runs a fund basically that invests in monopolies.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Because he realizes how well it works, you know?
Yeah.
And
well,
he tries to do ones that aren't awful.
As egregious.
Them. Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll tell you what, if you don't own a big slug of monopolies in your portfolio, good luck keeping up with the S&P 500.
I mean, it's been a huge part of Warren Buffett's investment strategy for the last 50 years. So
yep.
For a reason.
Yep.
But for the country and for growth, for competing with other countries, like it's not good because you end up getting too sluggish, too big. Like anyone that's ever worked in a small organization and a big organization, you know the difference between
how
well they operate. So
we've
been in a small organization that got big and watched the erosion of the vibrancy and the ability to like quickly to take action on things and improve things. So
yeah, well, and I think you put it well. I think when a corporation reaches a certain size, everybody starts playing prevent.
You got to make a policy for everything. Like,
yep.
And it's not like you're wrong to do that. You have to, but it just comes with the territory.
It's just, yeah, it just eats away at efficiency and you know, independent thinking and all those kind of things. And then as a corporation does that, it becomes something that metastasizes on itself, right? Because the way you get ahead in that corporation is not by innovating and pushing the edges.
Exactly.
Right? You do it by kissing, you know, pressing the right pulse and kissing the right behinds. Anything else that we need to get to? What's coming up on do we have any other economic data coming out this week?
Yeah, there's a lot, but like not a lot of
nothing big.
Yeah, not a lot of like really important stuff. That's the best way I can characterize.
Hey, I this is a conversation we're already at the end of our time. We've gone over, but have leading economic indicators been way less accurate than they have in the past over this cycle?
Yeah, 100% they have.
Is that just because of interventionist policy, central bank policy? Because remember, we had that whole conversation about how central bank policy literally is the muting out of economic winds or macro winds, right? Remember that discussion we were having? I think it was like last week or the week before.
I think it's a few things. One, it overweights the importance of manufacturing in the economy, which was true 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, not less so now. That's part of it. Another part is it puts a lot of weight on the yield curve. I think that's probably. And this took Kevin Muir uncovering something for me to like understand like why that might not be the case anymore. When the Fed changed the way they do monetary policy in 2008, I would argue that changed the signal within the yield curve. Now, if they go back to no duration on their balance sheet, no, you know, 10 plus year bonds, you might start putting some signal back in. Overweighting those two things, manufacturing and the yield curve, I think got the leading economic indicators into control.
That was
a giant deficit, just makes it hard to have a recession.
I think if I remember correctly, I think that was one of the reasons why I had Kevin Muir on in the first place, because, you know, being a guy that was on the more bearish side of it, I remember coming to that epiphany because what does the yield curve really represent? What the yield curve really represents is demand for duration. Really is what it's telling you, right? Now it can feed over into issuance, but still it's telling you, it's basically telling you what the demand for the different levels of duration are, right? Well, when the single largest buyer of all of that stuff becomes the Fed,
messes with the signal.
Yeah. We don't even know where rates are at this point.
And they used to sell a bunch of front end stuff to get rates up, and now they don't have to. So it really changed the signal, I think, for sure.
Did they used to actually sell it or just let it roll off?
No, they would have to throw it in. So they would actively trade short end rate stuff to move the interest rate. Now they don't. Now it's all about how many reserves are out there. So they went from the like a corridor to a floor system. Because in 08 you got to zero. Once you got to zero, like, you can't play that game anymore. So that's when they changed it. It's interesting because now that we're back up to 5.5, you could argue, like, well, you can go back to the old way of doing it, and no one's even talked about that.
No.
But the fact that they want to get the duration off the balance sheet tells you maybe they at least recognize, like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this anymore.
Other thing I think is really interesting, going back to them wanting to raise or cut rates here, is, you know, for years I've said that the Fed doesn't want a lower Fed funds rate. I don't think that's the case anymore. Because, I mean, like, the intellectually popular, the intellectually attractive argument was the Fed doesn't care where it's at, right? If you can get a healthy functioning economy at 5.5% Fed funds rate, they'd rather have it there than zero. Yet at the same time, then you see them trying to cut here. I think that this is going to be one of those points where people look back and they go, wait, you guys were cutting? Like, what?
Yeah, as everything stands now, that is the case. Now, I will say this. I mean, I think we teased this last week, but completions on homes being built just ripped higher. And if those people that finished those jobs don't get new jobs, like, everything changes to me. Like, we have hammered construction employment on this show because it's so important to me. If that takes a decided turn lower, then to me, like, okay, now like, I'll stop hammering the Fed for cutting and talking about cutting, because at that point it probably makes sense. And that's possible.
But so they have never preemptively cut successfully. They've never done it.
I would say once, but it was so
okay. Different. Once. So, well, okay. So I know different. What you're talking. Yeah.
But it was so different that I don't even know if I want to give them credit for it.
You're talking about 92, right?
94. Yeah.
94. Yeah.
So, and cutting preemptively, but, like, I mean, it's just a different game now with the deficits, with inflation being, in my opinion, it's pretty sticky right now. Like, services and wages, like, we talked about at the morning meeting this morning, because I just wrote a piece about how, like, a lot of new retirements hitting is like, inflationary. And, like, the data point I gave and wrote about this week was people under 25, their wages are growing at 9%. And that has come down a lot. And that is more than double what was normal before the pandemic. So then, like, so when I hear people like, oh, the Fed wants to cut because, like, labor's loosening up, like, okay, if labor is so loose, why are young people getting a 9% wage growth right now?
No, and like you said, it's not loosening up. And that issue, and here's the other thing that we're going to have to face sooner or later. You're also losing. Thank you to fiscal and monetary policy and all that. And I think it's only accelerating that trend. But the brain drain you're getting out of corporate America right now because of that. Like, look, Boeing is in a mess of its own creation. That being said, all of the problems you're seeing Boeing have, they are unquestionably being exacerbated by the brain drain they've had there. And I'm telling you, for, you know, all the people that I've talked to, clients that work there, all that stuff, these guys have been telling me this has been going on for 6 years. They've also been telling me, watch, the maintenance issues are going to get worse and worse. Zach, I'm telling you, this is going down the drain. And you've seen it just play out exactly like they said. Yes. And you cannot just drain that much knowledge and talent out of an economy that fast, especially artificially.
You overly financialize, and yeah.
You've got it. It's starting to feel like you got fires on like four or five different fronts.
4 million baby boomers retire per year for the next few years. So, like, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of talent. That's a lot of.
I believe the number we're at right now, and for those that do quick math, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe the number you're at is either 14,000 to 15,000 a day.
Oh yeah, it's a massive number. I actually have the per day number in the piece I wrote this week, and it is large.
Yeah, it is.
And there are not enough Gen Z millennial.
Do you remember what the number was off the top of your head?
No. That sounds about right, though. It's something like that.
Yeah, it should be in the 13,000 to 15,000 range a day.
It was over 10,000. I'm pretty sure.
And like you said,
and it's going to be higher as long as the stock market's higher.
And guys, this is the problem that we've been talking about for so long. So. It's funny how this works in economics, but you'll notice every single thing you see, everything that starts transpiring it's a feedback loop, right? Because those guys are leaving the workforce. One of the reasons they're able to do it is because their 401ks are at record highs, right? As they leave the workforce, that company needs to fill that spot even more. So they got to push up pay, which accelerates inflation. I mean, it's just everything that was deflationary pre-COVID, it's all flipped.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning to watch all these massive drivers go, you know, kind of go in reverse.
It kind of reminds you of the Hydra. You know what I mean? Like you cut off one head and two more grow back.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's kind of you what you feel like is happening, right? It's like the monetary policy Hydra. And I feel like those heads are just exponentially, you know, ratcheting up. And you look like I said, point out Biden, listen to the Fed. The answer is still to throw money at every single problem they see, even when that is the problem.
Yeah.
All righty, man. Well, we went way over. That might be our longest dots of all time. 40 minutes. So apologize. Hopefully you guys – well, I hope you don't get stuck in traffic. But if you do, maybe this will help bide the time a bit. But anyway, we will be back as always tomorrow. Keep taking this trip down the path with us. Keep an eye on gold and Bitcoin. I think that's kind of the canaries in the coal mine, for lack of a better term, at this point. So as always, we will see you tomorrow, guys. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.